Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
On the last episode of Guilt.
We sort of clicked because I had a child that was playing soccer a lot, and he had two kids, a boy and a girl, that were playing soccer. So we clicked on the sports side of things. When was that found? Was it found after?
5 days after.
5 days after. See, that's obviously planted there, because by 5 days we'd searched, we'd gone past all our mills, that the Uniflow annealing system had been completely shut down and opened up. So we're talking not just maybe in a shift, so we're talking quite a lot had to be done. So if the hat and all that had been found 5 days later, then that's been put there.
Disturbs some people.
Today we can officially announce that New Zealand Steel has cracked the code.
On the 21st of June 2004, scientist Jim Donnelly vanished from his work at the Glenbrook Steel.
From Brevity Studios in New Zealand, I'm Ryan Wolfe, and this is Guilt.
Nothing in the early days to indicate that we were looking for somebody who had been any misadventure.
You're on hands and knees, and you don't know what you're going to find. It started off as a joke, and then it got rather scary.
If anybody out there has any information that can help me put this victim home.
In the last episode, we met Brian Meeklejohn and learned a lot about the operation of the rolling mills plant and the subsequent search by himself and other mill workers in the hours and days following Jim's disappearance. We also discovered that Brian was one of the last people to ever see Jim alive and actually spoke to Jim that morning about their children's upcoming soccer matches, which if true, would go a long way to demonstrate that Jim was in a normal, stable frame of mind that morning. And highlights a particularly troubling element of this case, and that's the fact that staff at the mill were only asked to come forward and speak to police if they believed they had information of any relevance, as opposed to the police questioning everyone at the mill at the time. In reality, the reason this likely never happened is because from the very outset of this case, the police believed there wasn't really a case at all. In their minds, Jim had simply run off. So far, we've spoken to those closest to Jim, those that were directly involved in the bizarre events that led up to Jim's disappearance, Tracy, Stephen, and Debbie. However, there is a fourth person that was a close friend of Jim's at this time and was directly involved in the immediate hours upon the discovery that Jim had disappeared. His name is Clayton Hills, and he recalls his thoughts of the police investigation in the early hours.
Stephen called you or...
Yeah, he rang me. I remember I was in my office, and he said he was worried about Jim and that Tracy had rung him and hadn't heard from him. And he said, oh, I'm not sure what we should do. And I just said, we've got to go out there now. This is not right. We just go. So we drove out to the mill to try and sort it all out. And as you know, it was a pretty windy night. It was a pretty bad evening because we tried to talk the police into getting a helicopter in to try and do a search around the area, but they wouldn't do that, and that sort of thing. So we were taken into a boardroom area, and they'd then done a search through and couldn't find him, couldn't contact him, and I think that's you know, they then called the police in after that, but we were just sort of held in a boardroom area while they did that, because you know they didn't want anybody obviously going into a production area like they had there. So yeah, we were held there and then went on quite late, and then they, because some of the worst thing I think was they weren't sure whether he'd gone into one of the furnaces, so they had to wait until they were emptying the furnaces and they would have been able to tell whether any contaminant was in there. So that happened the next day and there was nothing, which is a relief, if you like. But there was a pretty hard wait. Yeah.
What did you sort of feel like their response was like at the time?
The mill, they were obviously concerned and went through those steps, which was is quite, I suppose it's what you can expect of a process like that. Obviously, it was more what the I think the police treated it slightly differently, which in not, well, I don't know, because I suppose that they just have to look at it in the way they did. When I spoke with one of the security guards on the gate, he said the police never actually ever spoke to them. Didn't ask them whether they'd seen anything coming in or out or anything. That was very surprising.
And so what are your thoughts on the police, their whole, you know, investigation in the early stages?
Yeah, it was almost like they'd semi made up the mind. I can't remember his name.
There was a Yearberry.
I think it was Yearberry. Yearberry. He was the first one from Pukekohe that was out there that night. You know, he was the one that I was trying to get, you know, see whether they could get the helicopter in for. But, they weren't not taking it seriously, but were, it was quite light on his actions, if you like. Yeah.
If you recall from episode 2, when we learned about the timeline of events, it is some surprise that following the initial search of the mill during the day, come 11 p.m, the wider search was called off till morning. Hindsight is certainly 20/20, but we can now assume that these hours were likely crucial. If Jim, or perhaps his body, was somewhere nearby, it would have been this first night that he could have either fled or his body have been removed. I asked Clayton about this and how he felt about it at the time.
Did it frustrate you a bit that everything stopped that night? Because from my understanding is at about 11 o'clock that night, they called it to start the next day.
Yeah, and I think that came from the police because I said, well, if he's out around, we should have the helicopter with the heat-seeking looking for it, and they wouldn't do it. And I said, well, if it's a case of money, we'll pay for that. And it goes, no, we're not going to do that. So, yes, it was frustrating, but it would also be very difficult in the dark to have looked. You know, it would have been ideal if you had heat-seeking equipment, but for searching around the property. I did go out a couple of days later with a search and rescue team, and we went entirely around the whole area. We spent a day going through it, and did that a couple of times with them, and guys that look for people that are lost for various reasons, and going through all the outbuildings and everything, just going over everything again.
It seems clear that in the first days of Jim's disappearance, the original police had quickly come to the conclusion that there was no foul play involved and that he had simply run off. And to be fair to them, in these early stages, there genuinely was no reason to believe anything untoward had taken place. So I wonder what then was their reaction when Jim's hard hat was unexpectedly discovered on Saturday the 26th, 5 days after his disappearance.
So then I guess we'll go to, if we jump ahead to that Saturday when the hard hat and items are found. Do you remember when you found that, when you were told that, and what your reaction was?
Yeah, it was pretty surprising. Everybody thought, well, hold on, you've done all the search and then suddenly you find this. So it almost seemed like somebody had planted it, and therefore it sort of should have highlighted something, even bigger for the police, if you like. They did, to be fair to them, the police did stay in communication all the time while they were going through that, because that was when they were draining the acid bath, which takes actually a lot of light acid bath and that sort of thing. So, it seemed pretty strange that something could, in that environment, suddenly be sitting there. So,
I can almost imagine that for police at the time, the discovery of Jim's hard hat and items in the acid vat would have likely been a thorn in their side, evidence that would apparently refute the idea that Jim had simply run off. I asked Clayton what their reaction was to this discovery.
Do you remember what their reaction was, or how they did explain it to you?
They couldn't really explain why it was still there. You could sort of say the bits that were found in the tank, you could understand if somebody just threw it in at any time. But to find the hat on the outside at the same time, they had no idea why that would be. Mm. As to why, in theory, that they'd missed it for the whole week.
I'm probably starting to sound a bit like a broken record at this point. We keep rotating back to the discovery of this hard hat. And there's a reason for this, and that's pretty obvious. It's crucial to this whole case. And don't worry, I'm going to spend a dedicated episode very soon going over every detail about the hat itself, its discovery, and every other aspect of it. But for now, I want to hone in on something key about its discovery and the subsequent police reaction, or more accurately, inaction. Prior to the discovery of the hard hat, Mills' staff had been asked by police to come forward on a voluntary basis if they had seen or interacted with Jim in the time surrounding his disappearance. But we know from speaking to Brian, whose name doesn't appear in the official timeline, that not everyone came forward. And to be fair, this is somewhat understandable. As Dave Glossop rightly said in episode 2, not every case can be pursued as a homicide case in the early hours. It would be paralysis by analysis. But I would argue that the moment the hard hat was discovered, this would present at least a reasonable possibility that someone else might have been involved in Jim's disappearance. So the question is, how did this affect the police response? Did they ramp up their investigation? Did they question every mill employee that worked during the hours since Jim's disappearance? The short answer is no.
My understanding is that their thought was that Jim had sort of come back. And this is the only explanation they can come up with, which just sounds...
So it's crazy, because you can't really sneak around. Because like I say, when we went inside, I was really surprised. It wasn't a dingy sort of work environment. If somebody was in there, you would see them. So for somebody to sneak around and do that, So that just sort of showed their thinking of trying to palm it off.
In a way, they sort of backed themselves into a corner, and then when that showed up, they had nowhere to go, really, did they?
Yeah, and because they hadn't locked that stuff down on the first day, they had nowhere to go.
So then after that, I guess what happened from there? Did it sort of just slowly fade away in terms of the police effort?
Yes. And then the mill, for a better term, the mill wanted to move on, if you like, and was not sort of keen for some of the stuff to being re-examined or pursued. So that and the police weren't necessarily pushing that to make that happen.
Mm.
So that was a major frustration.
Yeah. Mm. They basically wiped. They were like, it's not here, that's it.
Yeah. And having been on with the search and rescue team, when they went through it, when we did a ground search, to say that he would have come back afterwards was just ludicrous. Yeah, it's just ludicrous.
Let's pause for a moment and imagine a fictitious scenario. Let's pretend that in the early stages of this case, police knew it was a homicide investigation. Let's say, for instance, that Jim's body was found in the mill and that he had been murdered. How would this police investigation have been different? What do you think is the first thing they would have done? I'm not a police investigator, but I think it's fairly obvious that they would have questioned every person in that mill. But why question everyone if they hadn't seen or interacted with Jim? Well, if we know there's at least one other person involved, we're now looking for additional evidence which may create a new lead. When were you working your shift? Did everyone sign in when they should have? Were all members of your crew present between the hours of 6 a.m. and 9 a.m.? Had anyone on your crew been acting unusual or agitated in the time surrounding Jim's disappearance? Of course, we know there was no body and no obvious homicide. But should the police have stepped up their investigation the moment the hard hat and items in the vat were discovered? In my opinion, yes. It would be through questions like these that potential irregularities would be found, pressure would be applied, and if there was someone else involved, it's likely it would have been discovered. So the question is, were there people working at the mill at that time that may have further knowledge about Jim's movements? I believe the answer to this question is yes. And there's a reason why many of these people likely never came forward. And this has to do with a directive that was given to employees working at the mill at the time. The following statement is from a mill staff member we'll call Peter, who would prefer his real name and voice not to be used for fears of reprisal, so it has been voiced by an actor.
We got communication from the company that said you're not to talk to any reporters or any police without having a rep with you at the time, like a company rep. So you can imagine how excited you are to go and sit in that room and sort of almost snitch on your employer, if you know what I mean. And even though you're not like, it's not like we killed the dude or anything and we're hiding it, but you know what I mean? Like, it's never a good look.
I don't currently have written proof of this directive, but I have verified it with a second source who was working at the mill at the time to be an accurate statement. We have to wonder, why in the case of a missing employee would NZ Steel issue such a directive? The only real defensible reason they could offer would be to protect against any employee sharing possibly proprietary information. But is this really the reason? Is it more likely that NZ Steel were attempting to control the situation? A situation which, to be frank, shouldn't have been theirs to control. The direct result of this communication is obvious. Staff members that may have had further information simply didn't come forward, knowing the potential harm that might have on their career. Can you imagine the outcome of speaking to police or media in a negative light about the mill as an employee? Like Peter said, no one likes a snitch. I want to add here that at this point, I have no reason to suspect any kind of cover-up or wrongdoing on behalf of NZ Steel. But what I am suggesting is that through their authoritative measures, people that likely had additional information didn't come forward. And as we all know, any little piece of information can be key. Oftentimes, it's something that the witness doesn't even know is important because they aren't privy to every aspect of the case. So now, I want to reach out to you. and provide those people who either worked or still work at the mill the opportunity to speak anonymously, without fear of reprisal. If you had any interaction with Jim in the days leading up to his disappearance, I want to hear from you. If you were working at this time at the Glenbrook Mill in any department and noticed any odd behaviour of any staff, strange, out-of-place comments after Jim's disappearance, or anything you saw that made you stop and think, anything, I want to hear from you. Please don't think that what you know doesn't matter. It does. If you're aware of who placed Jim's hard hat beside ringer roll number one, please contact me. I can assure you 100% of anonymity. You can email at brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com. At the end of the last episode, I was just making my way out to the Glenbrook Mill for the first time. I know I won't be able to access the mill itself, but I can get an idea of the surrounding farmland, any bush, the nearby estuary, and just a general feel for the topography of the area. Obviously, if Jim has left the mill somehow other than the main gate, either Jim or someone else would have had to contend with the surrounding environment. One key element is an access road to the south of the mill, Williams Road. I managed to speak to some of the residents on the street about what they could remember in the days surrounding Jim's disappearance. The first person I spoke to had decided to reach out to me regarding his recollection of the search that took place at the time, and the fact that despite their location directly opposite the back access road to the mill, they were never spoken to.
It's always surprised me when people said there was extensive searches taking place, because as I say, we lived directly opposite what they termed a stage two expansion gate. So it was a locked gate, but it was a driveway up to the back side of the steel mill. And at the end of our road was another access back road, and it was all the steel mill farm was all around us. And we didn't see anybody, basically. Never got interviewed, didn't have anybody check our property, or can't recall anybody checking the bush opposite us or the driveways or on the road. My wife did recall someone there with a dog, but that was when the case was re-looked at a few years later.
So where you guys lived, so across from you, across Williams Road, there's quite a bit of farmland around that area before the mill. Did you guys used to go walking through that area?
Yep. So we walked, my wife used to walk our dog all through the mill property. We used to ride, she used to ride her horse on the mill property, and I used to walk with her at times. So we covered a lot of the mill property.
Yeah. And so,
this side of it, yeah. They own two sides of the property, two sides of it. And we were, you know, on the Woku side, I suppose you could call it.
Mm. And so on a day to day basis, sort of, you guys would go for a walk through the farmland sort of every day, probably?
Just about every day, yeah.
Yeah. And in that time, you never really saw anyone searching?
No.
Wow, that's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, so we've always sort of said that about, as I said before, you know, when everybody said about extensive searches. And I mean, you'd think our place would have been a prime. We were the first house on the road. Straight opposite the gate, one of the main gates. Everybody had to drive past our place to get up the road. There were several houses, you know, quite a few houses along the road.
I'm going to include a map of this area of Williams Road to the south of the mill in this episode's companion post on my Instagram and our Facebook page. Just to be clear here, we know that a search did take place, but the question is, why were these nearby neighbours never questioned by police? Nor was their property ever searched. Williams Road is the only access to the southern side of the mill. You would think it would be prudent to question residents on whether they had seen any unusual activity in the days around Jim's disappearance, perhaps vehicles that might have been out of place. But it appears that, at least in the case of this resident, that never happened. However, where this resident doesn't recall seeing any searches, another can specifically remember extra activity when she came home that day.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
If you're looking for plump lips that last, you need to know about Juvederm lip fillers. With Juvederm Volbella XC and Juvederm Ultra XC, your lip look, whether it's subtle or bold, can last up to 1 full year with optimal treatment and no additional maintenance. Find a licensed specialist and see if it's right for you at Juvederm.com today. That's Juvederm.com. Add fullness to lips in adults over 21 with Juvederm Volbella XC or Juvederm Ultra XC. Do not use if you have severe allergies or a history of severe allergic reactions, or if you're allergic to lidocaine or the proteins used in Juvederm. Tell your doctor if you have a history of scarring or taking medicines that decrease the body's immune response or that can prolong bleeding. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. As with all fillers, there's a rare risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. For full, important safety information, visit Juvederm.com.
No, I had come home and there were, I was at uni at the time, and I came home and there were police cars everywhere. And there was all these people in the paddock just across the road. And we sort of didn't really, I don't know why, I didn't sort of think too much of it. It was like, oh my gosh, look, you know, and then didn't really see anything, so went inside. And then my dad had come home not long after me, and he comes running into the house, and he was real scared that something bad had happened because the cops were parked outside our house. You know, a little terrible for him, I guess. He just sort of said, you know, he's calling out to us, and you guys are right? He goes, yeah, you're all right. And then he sort of went over to the guys and spoke to them and said, hey, what's going on? And they said, oh, there's this guy missing. We're just having a look around and see if we can find him. And that was sort of... all we kind of got from that, and then we were just watching the news to see what was happening.
In terms of, I'm just looking at the map here, so across the road from your house, is there sort of like a line of pine trees or something there across a paddock?
Yes. Yeah, there was. There's not any more, though. But there was a line of pine trees there, and there was what we used to call the forest, which was sort of to the, if you're looking straight across the road, it was to the left of our house. There was a whole bunch of pine trees there. But they were that, yeah. So there was a whole bunch of pine trees that were just like a little, like patch of them, I guess.
Yeah.
And then sort of past that, there was like a hill, and then there was like a line of pine trees that lined that area that blocked the view of the thermal. Yeah. None of those are there now.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I was thinking, because I thought that line of trees would have blocked your view. So the people that you saw, were they on your side of those trees?
Yes, they were on our side.
Oh, so right up by Williams Road there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, how many?
The cop cars and the cars that were there were parked on Williams Road.
Yeah.
And we could just see heaps of people just walking through and just doing like a, you know, how they kind of stand in the line and go through all the grass.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it looked like to us. There were cops in normal cop uniforms, and then there was just some other people too that I can't really remember if they were in any kind of uniform or anything. Oh, yeah, because, yeah, there was like about at least 6 or 7 cop cars there.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah, so it was quite big.
When you look across the road sort of from where you were living over to the mill, is it quite sort of a bushy? Are there lots of places to hide? And, you know, do you think someone could hide and not be found?
Not really. It was pretty open and... Like, I mean, my dad was in that area quite a lot, you know, shooting and stuff around that area, and then around the surge ponds as well, and sort of on the other side of the mill. So he knew that area quite well. It wasn't really, like, we'd been for walks and stuff around there. There wasn't really any places to hide. There were little tiny sort of bushes, like there's one there called, I want to say Dumbledore, but it's probably not that.
Dumbledore.
Dumbledore is the one that's sort of there, and it's just like a very small patch of trees.
Yeah.
And my younger siblings used to play in them.
Yeah.
I never played in them, but I didn't move up there till I was 18. So they were quite often playing in them with their friends and stuff, but there wasn't really, like, not that you could hide for a long time anyway.
You know, if someone was running out over that farmland, you know, someone's going to see you.
Yeah, it was quite, I mean, apart from those little pockets of kind of little trees, but even the little pine forest that was kind of just to the left of our house, I mean, we could see the kids playing in there when they were in there.
Yeah.
So it wasn't like super secluded. And plus we had a dog that would, you know, would have, and wasn't tied up, that would have gone over and made a bit of a noise. And I know the neighbours at the time had a dog as well. So there was, you know, and like we had the, there was a farmer who was driving constantly up and down the road, doing things. I don't know his name, but he was, I think we just called him Kelly.
Yeah.
And he's from what I understand, I think he's dead now. And we also had the Stillmore security driving up and down that road about four times a day and then into the night as well. So they would have seen something too.
Oh, okay. So the security, yeah, that's so, for the mill, they would come down there.
Mm-hmm. To come, yeah, because there's the back end, like there was an entrance there to the mill. Not that it was used very often, but quite often, like they would drive past all the time. You know, and if we were out walking, like, and it was nighttime, they would stop and talk to us. So if they had seen any, and quite often they had torches, you know, like if they saw a possum or something like that, they were looking. So they would have seen somebody as well, had somebody been hiding there.
Yeah, it sounds like they had, the security was pretty tight.
Yeah, I heard a rumour, something about there was people were stealing copper from the end. So if you go down Williams Road and you go right down to the end, there's a gate there, and people were stealing copper and coming out that way.
Okay.
I never saw any of it, and I don't know how much of it was true, but that was kind of the rumour anyway.
I've confirmed through a source from the mill that there was indeed a significant copper theft from this rear entrance to the mill at some point prior to Jim's disappearance, and this likely caused an increase in security. And when taken in consideration with the apparent lack of places to hide, it certainly seems that leaving the mill in this direction without being seen would not be likely. Either way, I'm very keen to get out there and see it for myself. Okay, I've just come out to, I've done the turn off to come and have a look at the steel mill. Never been out here before. I just wanted to sort of get my reaction for the first time I come out based on what I'm seeing around me. It's just farmland, just sort of rolling farmland with patches of bush. You know, just sort of standard New Zealand. I'm going to go here. There's a steel mill lookout here, which I'm going to pull over into. Let's have a look and see. I have no idea what this is. Oh, there's some bollards, plenty of graffiti. Okay, let's jump out and take a look. Yes, I'm on a lookout which is surrounded by nice New Zealand bush. There's a little pathway here up to a lookout where I can see just big, big buildings. A lot of smoke coming out. Many, many stacks with smoke. I mean, I don't know if it's smoke or steam. I can't see a huge amount of the place, but if I jump up on top of this railing without falling, if I can manage it. Oh, no, I'm going to fall in. Yeah, I mean, it's a big place. To give you an idea, I mean, it's many, many stories high. Just building after building after building.
God, I'd love to get in there and have a look around. At this stage, it's probably not likely that they're going to let me in. But who knows, we'll see. So what can I... Yeah. I can see one of the buildings has a sign, slab making, so that's probably where they're making the big slabs of steel that Brian was talking about before it ends up getting rolled in the rolling mills plant. And big car parks. Don't know if I can walk down. Actually, I might walk down this bit. See if I can get a bit closer. Obviously, security's pretty tight these days. Oh, yeah, I can see a bit more. Oh, right, so I can see, actually, hundreds of coils. Which I imagine are, wow, hundreds of coils. Wow. Yeah, I mean, I can't see a huge amount other than just a huge, huge operation. Right, I want to go find Williams Road. I would say, to be fair, around here, there's a lot of bush. There's a lot of bush. How much of this was here 20 years ago? I'm not sure exactly. All right, let's get up here. Oh. There's a chicken. Hello. Hello. He's like a cool little bantam chicken or something. Come on. Come on. No, he doesn't want to borrow me. Right, so I'm going to go try and find this Williams Road. Oh, there's a bunch of chickens. Hey guys, Jesus, they're trapping me in here.
I managed to escape the mill's roaming chicken security and jump in my car to head south of the mill to find Williams Road. It's in this area that a majority of the search for Jim took place, and my purpose for visiting is really to get a feel for whether I think it's possible Jim or someone else transporting a body could leave in this direction without being seen.
Okay, I've gone back up the road a bit. This is Williams Road. It doesn't have a signpost, but it must be Williams Road. Now, this is where I've spoken to a couple people that live down this road. And it's kind of speculated that, oh, you see, there's Dumbleton Bush. I mean, it is very thick bush. Right, so this first house here, the guy I spoke to, said they didn't see anything. Cop cars. But others said that they did. Now I'm looking at this area. This is south of the mill. To try and get a gauge on whether a person could escape down this way and not be seen by these people here, the neighbours on this road. You know, it's very open here. It's very open. I mean, it's kind of rolling hills, grassland with just sort of scattered small trees. But I mean, there's nothing. Could a person like Jim evade being seen down this way? I don't know. I suppose if I just put it this way, do I feel like I could come down here and not be seen when a whole lot of people were looking for me? I think it's probably not very likely, and I would consider myself pretty capable. So the road keeps going down here. Authorised personnel. We're just going to head down here anyway. Oh, actually, no, I think this is actually a road.
As I move down Williams Road, my initial feeling is no. it's not likely that a person or persons could move undetected in this area. But that changes as I make my way further along and get more of a sense of the bigger picture.
So I'm down south, looking back at the mill. Jeez, it's massive. The size of these buildings, it's hard to... It's like some kind of dystopian city or something. Plumes of smoke or steam or whatever coming out. It's quite impressive.
I reach the end of Williams Road, where it terminates with a newer style house, which according to signage, is owned by the mill itself. I stop and jump out of the car and try and take in my surroundings. At the same time, I can't help but visualize all those years ago, dozens of searchers combing these paddocks and gullies, looking for any sign of Jim.
Jump out here for a second. Yeah, so I'm south of the mill now, looking back at it. It's a cross rolling sort of farmland, but there are quite significant gullies with bush and stuff in them. Could someone come this way and avoid being seen? Now, to my left or to the west, that's where the Waiuku River comes in here and eventually runs up to Waiuku. It's a significant expanse. I wouldn't want to try it. I mean, you wouldn't swim across there. I've got to admit, coming out here now, it's not exactly what I was... Is it what I was expecting? I'm not really sure. There are some big groves of trees. But I mean, there's big open areas of paddocks, mainly. And then near the mill in particular, there's really some big trees and gullies full of bush and... But then down by the water's edge, you know, it is quite thick bush down there. I mean, and the other thing too is there's no guarantees that if he did get out, he came south. He could have gone to the north. But that certainly, you know, doesn't seem like the way that you would go. Right, well, I don't think there's much more I can see right now. I'll take a photo of this, put it on my Instagram so you can get an idea of what we're looking at here. Yeah, I mean, I think someone trying to sneak out the back way here across this farmland through here, I just don't think you're going to get through here without being seen. I just don't. The other thing to consider too is if he had somehow ended up in the water somehow. I mean, we're talking about June. It'd be freezing cold. At that time of the morning, you'd probably be hypothermic in 10 minutes in the water. Why he would enter the water, I have no idea. Oh well, it's been a good day. I've been able to get on site and for the first time get an idea of what we're looking at here, and yeah. The scope is kind of what I imagined, but it's actually even probably bigger than what I expected.
The possibility of Jim somehow ending up in the Waiuku River is certainly something that cannot be ignored. Whether he went in there of his own free will or not, I've heard stories about people that end up in the water in a certain place at the right time, never being seen again. I've checked the historical tidal charts, and it was an outgoing high tide at 7:30 a.m. the morning of Jim's disappearance. Is it possible that Jim was swept out? It's possible. Why that would happen, I can only speculate. But as I stand here, the expanse of water right next to the mill looks threatening, and not the kind of place you'd go for a swim. I jump back in the car and start making my way down Williams Road and home for the day. But as I drive back past the row of houses, I pause and jump out again. Something that's interesting here is that I'm standing over where the houses are on Williams Road, and from where the houses are, there's actually sort of a berm hill that's between them and the steel mill itself, and then there's a huge amount of paddock before the mill. So if someone were to get out, let's say Jim had gone out of the paddock, out of the mill, and then run across the paddocks, they would never see from the house here anyway. If he ran in this direction, sure, but you could run in the other direction down the coastline and no one would see you down there. Especially no one from these houses anyway. Which is, it looks very different than when I... very different than when I looked on Google Maps.
When looking from above, it looks as though the row of houses would have clear view of the field south of the mill. And while they do have a view of some of that area, the topography of the ground actually prevents them from seeing 80% of the fields below the mill. So while I feel you would easily be seen by a person at the end of the road, upon further inspection on my way back, I don't think you would from the row of houses at the start, which would explain why the first resident I spoke to doesn't recall seeing any searchers. While there was apparently security that would drive up and down Williams Road a few times a day, that still leaves ample time for either a person to escape in this direction, or perhaps alternatively, could a vehicle have accessed the southern side of the mill via Williams Road, collected someone, and then left without being seen? The short answer is yes. I'll include a map of this road and photos in this episode's companion post, demonstrating the way the road could be used to provide access for a vehicle. We know that at least the first resident on the street was never questioned regarding Jim's disappearance, or their property ever searched. So it appears there was no effort in these early days to establish whether there had been any unusual activity. I want to stress that I'm not saying this did happen, I'm just saying that it's possible. And at the very least, it certainly can't be ruled out. I drove down Williams Road, got out of my vehicle, and I didn't see a single person. So there's no reason to believe that someone else couldn't have. And in a case where nothing seems to make any sense, and no progress has ever been made, we really need to keep an open mind to the possibilities, however strange they may seem. It's funny, when you're investigating a case like this, sometimes new information or leads can come from the most unlikely places. While I'm in my car on my way home, my phone beeps. It's a message from one of the residents I interviewed on Williams Road. It turns out, her father was actually one of the original detectives in charge of Jim's case. And he's more than happy to speak to me.
But I'm out on the boat having a fish.
Oh, are you?
Catching nothing.
Oh, right. Oh, so probably not the best time for a talk now anyway.
No, we'll probably sit down and have a coffee, mate. So if you had any questions, I could ask them.
Guilt is written, produced, and edited by me, Ryan Wolfe. The title track is Nuclear Conception by Alison Winter. For further photos and video related to this episode, you can find a companion post on my Instagram, RyanWolfNZ, or our Facebook page, Brevity Studios NZ. For ad-free listening and bonus content, you can subscribe for the price of a coffee on Apple Plus under our Brevity Studios channel. You can also find further information on our website, www.theguiltpodcast.com. If you have any information related to the disappearance of Jim Donnelly or the subsequent search at the mill, you can contact us anonymously at brevitystudiosnz@gmail.com. On the next episode of Guilt.
You know, a good clue, and it all fits in. You know, Jim's missing and he likes sailing, and this guy needed a crew member. Finally, I was able to contact him on a satellite phone. Apparently he figured out, was looking at a way how to get that out.
Yeah.
And if you do that, suddenly this problem for the mill, which is the slag, which looks terrible, it kind of ruins the nearby country area, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
So it'd make that very valuable.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.